The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro. Continued, Cassette 13, Side 1. Then Fortas turned to another legal avenue, bringing the appeal before a single judge. And now his reasoning was more complex. Since a single circuit court judge could stay a lower court's injunction if that injunction would make ineffective a later judgment of the full court, most of Johnson's lawyers had been recommending making the strongest possible argument to a circuit court judge whose strict constructionist views and previous record made likely a favorable ruling. Fortas said that this course, too, would be unwise. Since the sole issue would be jurisdiction, whether Davidson had been correct in taking authority over the case, making such a plea to a single judge would smack too strongly of lawyers simply asking one judge to overrule another. No matter how persuasive their plea, he said, a judge sitting alone would be far more likely to deny it than the full circuit court. In any case, the judge would almost certainly want to consider the issue for several days to take it under advisement. Should his ruling then prove unfavorable, no time for taking another course of action might remain before the October 3rd deadline. Even if he granted the stay, too many days of consideration would, while giving Johnson a legal victory, doom his chances of being on the ballot. Fortas felt confident that the jurisdictional grounds would persuade a single Supreme Court justice, particularly the justice with administrative responsibility for the Fifth Circuit, Hugo Black, to do what a single circuit court judge would not, grant their plea for a stay of the injunction and thereby allow Johnson's name to go on the ballot. Getting the case before Black, however, represented a considerable problem. The circuit court route could not be bypassed entirely, since a Supreme Court justice would be unlikely to hear a case alone until lower court avenues of appeal had been exhausted. The problem was to get it up there in time in a way that would not result in a dismissal of it because it had not been passed on by the lower court, Fortas explained. It would have been a mistake to go directly to the Supreme Court, to Justice Black, and bypass the Circuit Court of Appeals. But if they took the case to the circuit court, to a single judge of that court, the case might be delayed there until it was too late for a ruling by Justice Black to help. A way had to be devised in getting a very quick hearing from the Court of Appeals, Fortas says. Fortas told the assembled attorneys that he had thought of a way, a very risky way. In the first place, he said, no affirmative action at all should be asked from the single circuit court judge. That would complicate the matter and make a delay in the judge's decision more likely. The only relief asked should be for a simple stay of the injunction on jurisdictional grounds, the issue on which a single judge would be most unlikely to overrule a fellow judge. The issue, in other words, on which an unfavorable ruling to their side was most likely. Then, Fortas said, they should try to make an unfavorable ruling even more likely by presenting to the judge not a strong argument, detailed, full, and persuasive, but a weak one, a plea offered in what Fortas called a summary way, a way that was not particularly convincing. And to further ensure an unfavorable ruling, they should try to select as the single judge, not, as the other lawyers had been suggesting, a judge who seemed predisposed to rule for their client, but rather a judge seemingly predisposed to rule against him. The combination of these steps, Fortas said, was the best way of obtaining a quick decision from a circuit court judge, a decision that would be unfavorable, but that would be fast enough to allow Johnson's lawyers then to present his case to Justice Black and to be able to tell Black that the case had already been appealed and lost in circuit court. Before Fortas arrived, Johnson's room full of attorneys had been trying to decide what was the strongest case they could present to a circuit court judge. Fortas was suggesting they present to that judge not the strongest case, but the weakest. Under his plan, the object was not to try to win in circuit court, but to lose, fast. Lyndon Johnson had two forums in which he might win an appeal from Davidson's decision, the full circuit court and then, if unsuccessful there, the Supreme Court. Abe Fortas was suggesting that he rely on only one, that in fact the first forum be surrendered by deliberately losing in circuit court. He was suggesting that everything be staked on the gamble that Black would agree to hear the case as a single justice and that Black would, after hearing it, rule for them. Deciding whether to adopt his plan was not, Fortas was to say, particularly difficult on the legal aspects of the case. What that decision mostly required was courage, he says. A man's political life was at stake. His suggestion, he was to recall, was not a conventional course of action. Lawyers like to do things by the book. B comes after A, and here we are skipping right through to Z. Moreover, the dangers involved in his plan were, he concedes, tremendous. By foregoing the chance to have the circuit court rule, Johnson would be gambling everything on black. You're doing a one-shot instead, Fortas was to say, and if you lose on that shot, you lose everything. But the most brilliant legal mind ever to come out of the Yale Law School had sliced its way through the other lawyer's verbiage to the heart of the matter. Skipping right through to Z was the only possible way that Johnson's name could appear on the ballot. So when Fortas had finished talking, there was dead silence. Not one of the previously voluble lawyers ventured so much as a comment. Everyone was delighted to have me take the responsibility, Fortas was to recall with a tight, sardonic smile. But Lyndon Johnson was a leader of men. The silence was broken by the voice, hard, flat, and decisive, of the man whose political life was at stake, the man who would lose everything if Fortas's gamble failed. "Let's do what Abe says," Lyndon Johnson said. Fortas asked for a secretary and went into an adjoining room. In what seemed an astonishingly short time, he had returned with a one- or two-page outline of a brief. "That's all you need," he said. The next day, they did what Abe had told them to do. Luther Jones translated Fortas's draft into a formal brief. The man known as the finest appellate lawyer in Texas considered himself honored to be allowed to work on a brief outlined by Abe Fortas. Jones was, as one magazine put it, the man with probably the finest technical knowledge in the state, but he knew enough to know how his expertise compared with Fortas's. "It was a thing of beauty to watch the way he handled it," Jones would say. "He listened to all of us for perhaps an hour, took all our work and got a secretary, and in 10 minutes came back with a very brief proposition. You see, a super expert doesn't need to beat around the bush. He knows exactly what needs to be done, and he does it." Jones himself flew, in a brown and root plane, to New Orleans to file the brief with the clerk of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Analyzing previous rulings by the court's 6 judges, a group of attorneys assembled by Tommy Corcoran in Washington found, in Judge Joseph C. Hutchison of Houston, a jurist whose record strongly suggested an almost out-of-hand rejection of Johnson's plea. Hutchison had once held, in fact, that a stay of a lower court injunction required the concurrence of at least 3 circuit court judges. In line with Fortas's strategy, therefore, it was to Hutchison that Johnson's attorneys applied for a stay of Judge Davidson's injunction, and Hutchison agreed to hear the application. And in the event, the court fight unfolded precisely as Abe Fortas had predicted it would. At the conclusion of a 4-hour hearing in his chambers in the federal courthouse in Houston on Friday, September 24th, Judge Hutchison caused consternation in the Johnson camp by announcing that he would take the case under advisement. But the advisement lasted only 5 hours. For Lyndon Johnson, of course, 5 terrible hours of waiting. What if the judge delayed his decision too long? Summoning the attorneys back to his chambers that same evening, however, Hutchison handed down his decision. The decision Fortas had forecast. Had Johnson's attorneys asked that something affirmative be done, the matter would be more complicated, Hutchison said. But if you merely ask that the injunction be stayed, I can't do it. I am only one individual. I can't act independently of the entire court in overruling another judge. It is quite clear that I, as a single circuit judge, have no power and ought not set aside or stay the injunction. The leaders of Johnson's Washington legal corps, Corcoran and the 3 senior partners of Arnold, Fortas, and Porter, thereupon telephoned Justice Black at his home in Alexandria, Virginia, on Saturday to ask if he would hear their application for a stay of the injunction. Black agreed to do so, setting the date for Tuesday, September 28th, to allow time for Stevenson to arrange for legal representation at the hearing. Harry Truman's campaign train pulled into San Antonio early Sunday morning, September 26th. Waiting at the station to greet the president was a crowd of politicians, including one so altered in appearance since he had left Washington in May to begin his campaign for the Senate that Jonathan Daniels, who had not seen him in the intervening months, was startled when Johnson boarded the train. "I think the most dramatic time I ever saw Lyndon Johnson was on that trip," Daniels was to recall. "He came aboard looking like the damnedest tramp I ever saw in my life. He couldn't have shaved in at least 2 days, and he looked sick as hell. If he lost at that point, he was pretty well licked for the rest of his life. He was going to be a great man or just another Texan. And at that point, he didn't know, and nobody else knew, which it was going to be. Someone handed him a large drink of scotch. His hands shook as he drank it. Johnson had been standing with other dignitaries, but went over to the crowd and began shaking hands, as if he couldn't stop. For Lyndon Johnson, Monday was a day of applause. Whatever Truman's feelings toward him had been before, Texas was indispensable to the president's own re-election chances in 1948, and two of the men most important if he was to carry Texas were on the train with him, Sam Rayburn and Tom Clark. And, as Evans and Novak were to put it, for all of his conservative transgressions during the 80th Congress, Lyndon Johnson would be infinitely preferable to the adamantly conservative Coke Stevenson in the Senate. And there were more immediate considerations. The president was anxious to keep Texas from joining Strom Thurmond's States' Rights Rebellion, and the people identified as States' Rights in Texas were Stevenson's supporters. At stop after stop, the president, with Johnson standing beside him on the back platform, told the crowds, "My advice to you is to go to the polls on Election Day and send Lyndon Johnson to the Senate." But there was another sound that day, too, the rap of gavels in South Texas courthouses. For a race began on this Monday, September 27th, 1948, a race which would determine Lyndon Johnson's future. It was run in two little courthouses in the Rio Grande Valley, and 2,000 miles to the north in the gleaming marble temple of the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. The two masters in chancery appointed by Judge Davidson, William Robert Smith, for 13 years United States Attorney for the Western District of Texas, and J.M. Mack Burnett, one of Smith's longtime deputies, issued subpoenas on Monday morning requiring election officials of Jim Wells, Duval, and Zapata counties to appear before them and produce their county's ballot boxes, poll lists, and tally sheets. The subpoenas were returnable that very afternoon. At 3 p.m. that day, Smith would begin the Jim Wells hearing in Alice, while Burnett simultaneously opened one in San Diego, the Duval County seat. The testimony of witnesses would be taken expeditiously, the two masters announced. Their hearings would be completed by Friday, so that their official written reports could be submitted to Davidson by the Saturday, October 2nd, deadline the judge had set. In Washington, Justice Black's hearing would not begin until Tuesday. Abe Fortas had assured Lyndon Johnson that Black's ruling would be favorable because of the jurisdictional grounds, but favorable or not, the ruling might come too late. If the poll lists and tally sheets were examined and the ballot boxes opened, and if the evidence in them, combined with witnesses' testimony, proved definitively in public, in court, in a sworn official record summarized in the master's official reports, that in Jim Wells and Zapata counties, hundreds of votes, and in Duval County, thousands, that had been counted in Lyndon's column were not votes at all, but simply figures added to tally sheets on the whim of election judges, not even a Supreme Court ruling could save his reputation. A ruling might not, in fact, be able even to save his seat. Pro forma, though most Senate investigations of elections might be, how could the Senate ignore proof, official, sworn court records, of such patent illegality? All that Monday and Tuesday, therefore, Johnson's attorneys in both Valley courthouses employed delaying tactics, abetted by further demonstrations of the difficulty of obtaining evidence in a land outside the law. The master's subpoenas had behind them the full authority of a federal court, but when United States Marshals attempted to serve them on election officials, they were, in most cases, unable to do so. The witnesses had disappeared. In Duval County, for example, more than 50 witnesses had been subpoenaed. Only 8 could be located. Many of the others, including election judges and clerks and County Democratic Committee Chairman Campbell King, were reported to be on vacation. In Mexico, where, of course, United States subpoenas had no force. In Jim Wells County, subpoenas had been issued for 3 key election officials. When Smith gaveled his hearing to order in the Jim Wells County courthouse, Marshal W.W. Ainsworth reported that not one of the 3 could be found. The most important official, Tom Donald, who had had custody of the election records and had refused to open the bank vault to allow Coke Stevenson's attorneys to inspect them, had apparently left town that very morning, just about the time the subpoenas had been issued, in fact. And when Smith, over Everett Looney's objections, began to probe into Donald's whereabouts, "The court wants to lay its hands on those records," the federal master was informed that Donald had left town without telling even his wife where he was going or when he might return. That night, Donald telephoned her to say he was across the border in Mexico. He gave her no hint where in Mexico, however, or what he was going to do there, or how long he was planning to stay. Those witnesses who were located, moreover, were in general somewhat less than helpful when they took the stand. Duval's county judge, Dan Tobin, testified that he did not know the names of 10 of the county's 11 precinct election judges, or any information to speak of about poll taxes, election returns, or any other aspect of the election. Another Duval official said that, yes, many several thousands of poll tax receipts had been financed by outside parties. He could not, however, recall who these outsiders were. The evidence had disappeared, too. If any piece of evidence was crucial, it was the poll list and tally sheet from Jim Wells' Precinct 13. Coke Stevenson's lawyers, who had seen these documents, were convinced that if they were produced in court, their contents would prove beyond doubt that the election had been stolen for Lyndon Johnson. The law required 3 copies of those documents, 1 copy sealed in the Precinct 13 ballot box along with the ballots, 1 copy in the custody of the secretary of the County Democratic Committee, and 1 in the custody of the presiding judge at that precinct, Luis Salas. Committee Secretary Donald, of course, was missing, but now Salas, previously missing, allowed himself to be found and served with a subpoena. As Stevenson and his attorneys, sitting in court, watched the burly former pistolero swaggering to the stand, they believed they were close at last to obtaining the proof they had been seeking. They were wrong. Salas was quite relaxed as one of Stevenson's attorneys, C.C. Renfro, questioned him. He seemed to regard the proceedings almost as a joke. Renfro took him through the election procedure and elicited from him the fact that he had indeed made the 3 required copies of the poll and tally documents, placing them in large manila envelopes about 2 feet square, and had indeed put 1 copy in the ballot box, given 1 to the Democratic officials, and kept 1 himself. And, Renfro asked, where is the one that you kept yourself? It is lost, Salas replied. Salas had a further revelation to make. It emerged as he was explaining the circumstances under which he had lost his copy of the records. Following the election, he said, there has been so much talk about this Box 13 that on September 15th he had decided to compare his copy with Donald's. You see, I had been hearing a lot of talking that there was something wrong with the election. The election was level, nothing wrong with the election. I went to get the copies from Tom Donald to compare with mine. After Donald gave him the committee's copy, Salas said he put both copies in his car and drove to a bar in Alice, the Bahía Española. I stayed there from 5, I guess, until 9:30, something like that, and when I come back, they had stolen everything from the car. This revelation did not sink in for a long moment. Then Renfro asked, you mean your copy and Donald's copy, too? Both lists were stolen? Both are lost? Yes, sir, Salas said. The poll list and tally sheet that Coke Stevenson and his aides had seen at the bank had disappeared. Salas had a few more points to make under questioning. He had indeed gone to the Alice News on the night of the primary, he said, and he had indeed seen the reporter Cliff Dubose there. But he said he had never told Dubose how many votes Johnson or Stevenson had received that day. I never said anything about how many votes anybody got. According to Salas's testimony, Dubose was a rather uninquisitive reporter. Did he ask you? Renfro demanded in a voice that was by now indignant. No, sir, Salas replied. Renfro, outraged, next asked Salas about the report that 200 votes had been added. It is not true, Salas said. Absolutely unruffled, he left the stand with a broad grin to shouts from the crowd of, Viva Luis Salas! Viva Indio! The same pattern of disappearing evidence was unfolding in Duval County as well, in Duval where thousands of votes were at issue. Only 8 of the 50 Duval election judges and clerks subpoenaed had been found, but as George Parr sat listening to their testimony, he may have felt that even 8 was too many. For their testimony reinforced the widespread belief that in his county they didn't vote him, they just counted him. One of the 8 was the presiding election judge at Precinct 6, Ernesto Benavides. He testified that after the polls closed on primary day, he made the required 3 copies of the poll and tally lists, placed 2 of them in the locked ballot box, and left 1, his own, at the schoolhouse at which the voting had been held. And where is your own copy now? He was asked. I do not know, he said. When he had returned to the school 4 or 5 days later to look for it, it was lost. Burnett, the Federal Master, interrupted quite sharply to take over the questioning himself. "Were the ballots from your precinct actually counted and included in the official total from the county?" the Master asked. At first, Benavides replied, "I don't know." Then he hesitated. In front of him, in the crowded little courtroom, George Parr sat waiting to hear his answer. "Oh, yes, the votes from Precinct 6 were counted," Benavides said. "How is that possible?" the Master demanded. "You testified that the results had been given to Campbell King at the courthouse that evening. How did the county chairman obtain the returns from your box if you left a list at the school and the other two were in the locked box?" "I do not know," Benavides replied. Stevenson's lawyers believed a similar situation had existed at most of the other 10 Duval precincts. During the 3 weeks since Koch's trip to Alice, they had found a surprisingly large number of men and women in the valley willing to brave George Parr's wrath. And they had affidavits which they felt proved that few, if any, of the 10 precincts had so much as bothered to file returns with county officials. Parr and his boys had simply written down any numbers they pleased, giving Johnson whatever totals the candidate or his aides said were needed. That was the explanation for the 100-to-1 majority. Only the lack of sufficient poll tax receipts had stopped Parr from giving Johnson even more votes. In Zapata County, there was a change in the wording of the script. Instead of the word lost, synonyms were employed, gone, for example, and missing. There was, however, no change in the basic plot. The key precinct in Zapata was number 3, where the late correction 6 days after the primary had given Johnson 45 crucial additional votes. The records from all 4 of the county's precincts, contained in 4 large manila envelopes, had been given to the county judge, Manuel Bravo, by the county Democratic chairman, Josefa Gutierrez, in Bravo's office. Mrs. Gutierrez testified that when she and the records were subpoenaed by the federal master, she had gone to Judge Bravo's office to get the records back and bring them to the hearing. Judge Bravo had thereupon given her envelopes, 3 envelopes. They were from precincts 1, 2, and 4. "I put 4 in, and there were only 3, Mrs. Gutierrez said. "I don't know what happened to the other. I didn't even know it was missing." Called to the stand, Judge Bravo said he didn't know either. He had put 4 in his filing cabinet, he said, but when he went to get them, there were only 3. Number 3 was gone. Its returns were missing. Nonetheless, the two masters did not let the missing witnesses and evidence stop their investigation. In the Jim Wells County Courthouse, for example, Stevenson attorney Josh Gross, after hearing Salas testify that the first 2 copies of the crucial poll list had been lost, told Smith, "Sir, I would like to suggest that there is 1 other copy of this poll list that is available. That is the one in the ballot box, and I would think that Your Honor, under the order of this court, would have the right to bring that ballot box into this court here, open the ballot box, and take out only the poll list, and we request the commissioner, Master, so to do." Johnson's lawyers leaped to their feet, Looney protesting that only an express order of the district court could authorize the opening of a ballot box. Tarleton, his shock of shaggy white hair awry as he stamped around the courtroom, his arms extended upward as if to call the heavens to witness this contemplated injustice, invoking broader grounds. "For a federal official to open a state ballot box," he shouted, "would be a return to the evil days of Reconstruction. There is still the doctrine of states' rights. Those ballot boxes are secure in their sanctity under the law of this state and are not the subject of invasion by outside authority." But Smith was firm. "I have the power to order the United States Marshal to impound those ballot boxes, and the Marshal is so ordered," he said. Writing out the order, Smith handed it to Marshal Ainsworth, who served it on the county clerk in his office down the corridor, and before the close of court Monday, 20 ballot boxes that had been used in the county's 17 precincts had been carried in by janitors and piled up in front of Smith's bench. Some of the cylindrical, rather battered tin drums with removable tops — voters had placed their ballots in the drums through slits in the covers — were labeled with precinct numbers. Some were not. Some of the drums were padlocked. Some were padlocked, but with keys dangling from the padlocks. Some were unlocked. Presumably the 20 included the box or boxes from Precinct 13. Koch Stevenson, sitting motionless at a council table, may have felt that there in front of him, not 5 feet away, was the evidence he had sought for so long. One of Lyndon Johnson's allies had said it was Johnson's major purpose not to permit the opening of Box 13. Now, a federal master had ordered Box 13 to be brought into court, and it was in the custody of a United States Marshal, ready to be opened. Whatever the condition of those tin drums, locked or unlocked, labeled or unlabeled, one of them either would or would not contain that last copy of Precinct 13's poll list. If the list was found, proving the legality or illegality of the 200 decisive votes would be swift and relatively easy. If the list was not found, such proof would be difficult, but in the opinion of the master on whose report Judge Davidson would base his decision on making the injunction permanent, the mere fact that all copies of the list had disappeared would be highly significant. Monday had been a day of applause for Lyndon Johnson. There would be no applause on Tuesday. No crowd noise would obscure the rap of the gavels. The campaign would have narrowed to that race in court. On that Tuesday in Alice, Texas, a federal master would begin opening the ballot boxes that were the heart of the investigation into Lyndon Johnson's senatorial campaign. On that same day in Washington, D.C., Justice Black would be deciding whether to halt that investigation or to allow it to continue. The starting time in both Washington and Alice on Tuesday was 9:30 in the morning, but because of the different time zones, the hearing in Washington began an hour earlier. So close was the race that 60 minutes lead might make the difference. Filing into Hugo Black's walnut-paneled, book-lined chambers in the Supreme Court building Tuesday morning was Lyndon Johnson's first team, Wirtz, Allred, and four prominent new dealers, Fortas, Thurman Arnold, Paul A. Porter, and Hugh Cox. Appearing alone for Stevenson was Dan Moody, who had disdained the help of younger attorneys. The civil rights issue, the key issue that authorized federal jurisdiction in the opinion of the young lawyers assisting Stevenson, was never raised. Sitting in a semicircle around the justice's desk, as Black rocked in his swivel chair, the attorneys presented essentially the same arguments they had been repeating for a month in lower courts. Moody said the issue was fraud, whether it had been committed on Lyndon Johnson's behalf and whether Johnson should be allowed to benefit from it. In ordering the master's hearing, Moody said, Judge Davidson had been attempting to prevent the reaping of a harvest from the perpetration of a fraud. Fortas said the issue was jurisdiction. Election contests were irrevocably and incontestably vested in Texas state law and should not be supervised by a federal court, weighing in with an argument that had significant political connotations during a year in which the balance of power in the United States Senate might hinge on Texas. Wirtz warned that if Stevenson succeeded in keeping Johnson's name off the ballot, there will be no name of a Democratic nominee. The Republican nominee will be the only candidate on the ticket. Down in the Alice courthouse, Parr had stationed a deputy sheriff next to the telephone in the county judge's office. Allred had been given the number of that phone and told to call the instant Black announced a verdict, so that in case the verdict was favorable, not a moment would be lost in stopping the Alice hearing. Parr had ordered the lines kept clear for a call from Washington. All Tuesday morning, with the lawyers still arguing before Justice Black, the phone did not ring. But although Federal Master Smith had planned to open ballot box 13 as soon as he convened his hearing Tuesday morning, he was unable to do so because the box first had to be identified, and the person called to the witness stand to identify it was Luis Salas. Laughing and joking to the appreciation of friends in the courtroom, Salas managed to do a thorough job of sowing confusion about which of the 20 tin containers was Precinct 13's. As Stevenson and his attorney sat grimly watching, unable to speed the process, Salas said that the ballot box into which he had placed the poll and tally lists was not among the 20 that had been brought to court. How he knew that was unclear, since he also said that he had placed no identifying mark of any kind on it. Then he said that Precinct 13 had had not one but two ballot boxes. Smith directed that Salas inspect the boxes. One by one, slowly, he looked them over and found for each one some reason why it was probably not from his Precinct 13. Finally, he tentatively, very tentatively, identified two. Thanks to the delay he caused, although the arguments in Washington lasted for almost 4 hours, when they concluded, at a little after 1 p.m. Washington time, and Black announced he would retire to consider his verdict, down in Alice none of the 20 boxes had been opened. At about the time that Black retired, Smith announced a recess for lunch. The outcome of the race, between Black's decision and the opening of ballot box 13, was still in doubt. During that lunch recess, Salas was informed that the two men who had actually marked the ballots would be put on the stand. If they were, Salas was to recall, he was sure they would be indicted. He told Ed Lloyd, "This investigation going bad for us, Ed." If the two men were in legal danger, he said, "I'm going to tell the truth." Don't say anything yet, Lloyd replied in panic. Hold your horses. After lunch, Salas returned to the stand, but none of the boxes had yet been opened when, on Tuesday afternoon, a clerk summoned Dan Moody and Johnson's sextet of lawyers to Black's chambers. The justice, he said, was ready to announce his verdict. Black agreed with Fortas. It would be a drastic break with the past, which I can't believe Congress ever intended to permit, for a federal judge to go into the business of conducting what is to every intent and purpose a contest of an election in the state, he said. The issue, he said, in an obvious reference to the balance of power in the Senate, is of supreme public importance. Not only are the parties interested, but the whole state of Texas and beyond the state. Black disagreed with Moody's contention that Stevenson had no other recourse but the federal courts. What about the Senate? He asked. The Senate is the judge of the qualification of its own members, finally. While, he said, fraud, very reprehensible fraud, had been charged, fraud was a criminal charge, punishable as crime if the charges are sustained. Therefore, he said, I am going to grant a stay until the full Supreme Court has an opportunity to consider it. Under the procedure in such hearings, Johnson's attorneys had to draft the order granting the stay. Instructing them to do so, Black said he would sign the order on Wednesday. Trotting, almost running out of Black's chambers, Allred telephoned Alice in San Diego to notify Parr's men of the verdict, and within minutes Smith recessed his hearing while he went into the county judge's office and telephoned Judge Davidson in Fort Worth to ask for instructions. Reporters had told Davidson of the verdict, but they did not know precisely what Black had ruled, and the district court judge had received no official notification. He did not yet know the scope of Justice Black's action, Davidson told Smith, but if it merely stayed the injunction, the master's hearings, being more in the nature of a trial on the merits, would have nothing to do with the injunctive matter. Informed that Black's order was not yet drafted and that Black would not sign it until the following day, Davidson instructed Smith to proceed with his hearing. Returning to the courtroom, Smith did so, over the furious protests of Johnson's attorneys. And when, a few minutes later, Salas finally completed his identification of the ballot boxes, the master said, "The court is going to open the ballot boxes." Jumping to their feet again and rushing to the bench, shouting at Smith, Johnson's lawyers stalled almost frantically to keep the boxes closed, Tarleton repeating his arguments that opening them would violate state laws and statutes, Looney saying, "If the practice permits, and I think it does, we should like time," to appeal directly to Judge Davidson for a ruling about the opening of the ballot boxes. But Smith said, "I have made my ruling." He had been appointed to find out the truth about Precinct 13, he said. That required the poll and tally lists, and two of the three copies of those lists had been lost. There is nothing left for me to do but to look in the third place where they are supposed to be, and if they are there, to examine them. Tarleton shouted that because of Salas's testimony, no one could even be sure which of the 20 boxes were Precinct 13's. Smith admitted that the attorney was correct, but added that if they, the two boxes Salas had identified, are not Precinct 13's, then I'm going to open the rest of them. He slammed down his gavel. In a voice that reporters called stern, he said, "We will open all the boxes if necessary." The covers of the two tin drums identified by Salas were secured not by locks but by baling wire twisted through the padlock hasps. Smith had Marshal Ainsworth bring him a heavy pliers. With them he untwisted the wire of the two drums, and then he took off their covers. One of the two drums was indeed a ballot box from Precinct 13, Jim Wells County. Despite his efforts to confuse the court, Salas had testified that on election day he had signed the back of each ballot. And when Smith reached into this drum, he found that the ballots inside were signed Luis Salas. Pulling seven out at random, they bore numbers from 229 to 1010, Smith asked Salas formally, "I ask you if that is your signature," and Salas acknowledged that it was. Then the master looked through the ballot box. It contained hundreds of ballots. It did not contain a poll list or a tally list. The second of the two boxes was not from Precinct 13. It contained ballots from Precinct 4. There were still 18 boxes piled up in front of Smith, and the master was determined to find out for certain whether the crucial lists were in one of them. If the lists were not in one of those boxes, either because when the second Precinct 13 box was identified and opened, the lists were not inside, or because there turned out to be no other box from Precinct 13 in the pile, that would mean that the third copy of the lists had disappeared like the first two, and in Smith's opinion, this destruction of every copy of Box 13's records would be the most potent piece of evidence of the illegality of the returns that had elected Lyndon Johnson. When Salas, recalled to the stand, continued to maintain that none of the other 18 boxes was the other box from his precinct, the master recessed the hearing until 9:30 the following morning, Wednesday, and announced that he would open the rest of the boxes then. Throughout that evening, lawyers worked in Washington to draft the text of an order for Justice Black's approval, and on Wednesday morning they presented it to him. Black retired to study it. Meanwhile, in Alice on Wednesday morning, the climax of the master's hearing was at hand. Jamming the benches of the little courtroom and lining the walls in the rear and the sides were witnesses, the witnesses who had testified in Fort Worth that they had not voted in Precinct 13 despite the fact that their names were on the poll list, and dozens of others, including the two men Salas feared would be indicted if they were put on the stand. The witnesses had been told that they would be called to testify that day, as soon as the master had finished opening the ballot boxes. And Louis Salas was in court again, and during the night his resolution had hardened. He would not allow his election clerks to take the blame. If they were called to testify, he would take the stand again and this time tell the truth. In front of Lyndon Johnson's attorneys were the ballot boxes. Behind them and all around them were the witnesses. They were surrounded by the evidence they had been fighting to keep out of the record. Desperately hoping for the arrival of Justice Black's order, they made a new time-consuming motion that required a ruling from Smith. Parr's deputy sheriff was again stationed in the county judge's office down the hall from the courtroom, waiting for the phone call from Washington that would keep the rest of the ballot boxes from being opened. But the call still had not come. "Let's proceed," Smith said. Because, perhaps unsurprisingly, the keys to the padlocks on 9 of the 18 boxes were missing, Smith sent for a locksmith, who began working on the 9 locks as Smith began opening the other 9 boxes. At one point that morning, the master let his feelings show through. As he was about to open a box, one that Salas said was not from Precinct 13, Tarleton said, "We object to the opening of that box because a witness has positively testified it was not Box 13. "That witness testified to a lot of other things, too," Smith said dryly, opening the box. The stream of frenzied interruptions by Johnson's attorneys continued. When Smith looked at the ballots to see which precinct number they bore, Looney objected to his examining ballots from other boxes. "I'm just trying to see if they are Box 13, Smith replied. "A violation of the sanctity of the ballot box," Tarleton shouted. "You have impeached the verity of the ballot when you have opened the box." Smith kept proceeding through the boxes. At the start of that Wednesday morning, 18 had stood between him and the proof he considered most potent. One by one that morning, the 18 were being opened. First came the 9 unlocked boxes. None contained the ballots from Precinct 13. There were 9 to go, and by this time the locksmith had opened them. The phone call from Washington had not come. The race was very close now. Shortly after noon, Smith recessed the hearing for lunch. When he reconvened at 1:30, that phone in the county judge's office had still not rung. Pointing at the 9 remaining ballot boxes, the master said, "Let's pass them up, please." He had opened 2, neither from Box 13, and was lifting the top from a third when, at 1:50, the phone rang. Allred was on the phone. Justice Black had just signed an order directing that all proceedings in the case be stayed until further order of the Supreme Court. Shoving his way through the spectators jamming the courtroom door, the deputy sheriff ran up to Dudley Tarleton and whispered to him. The white-haired attorney, oratorical tricks forgotten for once, leaped up and without a word to Smith ran behind the sheriff to the county judge's office, where Allred told him that Davidson had received Black's order and had sent a telegram to Smith and to Federal Master Burnett in San Diego, ordering them to halt their hearings. When Tarleton returned to the courtroom and informed Smith of this, the master telephoned Davidson, who confirmed Tarleton's report. Resuming his seat on the bench, Smith said, "Judge Davidson has just instructed me to close this hearing and proceed no further." He did so. The race was over. The third copy of the poll list had not been found, and never would be, but because 7 of the ballot boxes had not been opened, no one would ever be able to prove definitively that all 3 copies had vanished. The hearings ended in anticlimax. Smith told the courtroom that he would be unable even to file a report. "I hardly see how I could make any findings on a record wholly incomplete," he said. "The testimony was not all in, and one of the parties had not been heard, and the other party had been heard only in part. As a matter of fact, the plaintiff had just begun to develop the case when we adjourned." To this, Gross added a statement poignant to Stevenson's adherents. I am so full of what went on in Fort Worth which Your Honor does not know about. Well, Smith repeated, the whole record is not in. It will be, Gross said. Gross was wrong. On October 5th, the Supreme Court refused to hear Coke Stevenson's petition that it consider Black's stay of the injunction. On January 31st, 1949, the court rejected Stevenson's petition for a trial on the merits of the case. The hearing Judge Davidson had ordered would never be resumed. The remaining ballot boxes were never to be opened. The testimony of the witness who filed out of the Alice Courthouse and out of the courthouses in Duval and Zapata counties, without being heard, was never to be heard. The federal court's investigation of Lyndon Johnson's 1948 senatorial victory was over. Definitive proof that the decisive 200 Box 13 votes had not been cast was never to be obtained. Proof that thousands of other votes from the Rio Grande Valley, votes indispensable to Johnson's election, were not votes at all, but merely numbers written on a tally sheet by border county jefes, would never be obtained. Evidence that some of these votes were cast by dead men would never be presented in a court of law. Abe Fortas's strategy had worked with only a few minutes to spare, but it had worked. All other investigations were in effect over, too. Stevenson asked the Justice Department and the FBI to investigate the election. Attorney General Tom Clark agreed to do so, but the investigation showed, as one analysis put it, a notable lack of investigative and prosecutorial vigor. An historian has written, "The FBI investigation disappeared without a trace." Attempts by Stevenson partisans to interest the FBI and Justice Department more deeply in the case resulted only in a fancy dance without a serious investigation, as was also the case with the pro forma Senate investigation of the Texas senatorial election. After Lyndon Johnson easily defeated Republican Jack Porter in the November election, he was seated in the Senate. Chapter 16. The Making of a Legend. Although Lyndon Johnson was now a senator, interest in the 1948 election did not die down, and in 1952 it was fueled by an incident which created a sensation in the media in Texas. It involved one of George Parr's Mexican-American pistoleros, Duval County Deputy Sheriff Sam Smithwick, who in 1949 had shot to death a news commentator on an Alice radio station who had attacked the corruption of the Parr regime. Sentenced to life imprisonment, Smithwick, in 1952, wrote Coke Stevenson from the Texas State Penitentiary at Huntsville. He said that in 1949 he had recovered the missing Box 13 from the Parr aides who had originally been ordered to dispose of it. He had hidden it, he wrote, and could produce the ballot box if you are interested. He asked Stevenson to visit him at Huntsville to discuss this matter in detail. Receiving the letter at his ranch, Stevenson set out for the prison, but stopped in Junction to call and notify prison officials he was coming. They told him not to bother. Sam Smithwick, they said, was dead. He had committed suicide in his cell by tying a towel around his neck, attaching it to the window bars, and then slipping off his bed. Smithwick's letter, reproduced on the front page of the Dallas News, made headlines, banner headlines, throughout Texas, particularly after, as the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reported, some guards and prisoners at the penitentiary had talked of the possibility that Smithwick had been murdered. Somewhere, that article said, the thief who stole election records from Precinct 13 in Jim Wells County after the 1948 senatorial election squirmed uncomfortably. Publication of this letter intensified suspicions among Stevenson's supporters that the 20 boxes brought into the master's hearing had not included the box that contained the poll and tally lists, that only one of the two Precinct 13 boxes had been in court. A dramatic cartoon in the news depicted a terrified Lyndon Johnson cowering under the sheets in his bed, while above him a huge ghost held a locked box labeled Precinct 13. No evidence whatsoever was ever adduced to link Lyndon Johnson with Smithwick's death, and there is no reason to believe such a link existed. Nevertheless, so widespread throughout Texas was the speculation that the death might be connected with the 1948 election that, after attempting at first to ignore the issue, Johnson was forced to issue a statement saying that disclosure of Smithwick's letter appeared to be a continuation of a fight by a group of disgruntled, disappointed people. Johnson's statement did not, however, end the speculation, and it helped to keep the story of Box 13 alive in Texas. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.